talking about decision-making here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're looking more closely at this one question. Why are we so often uncomfortable dealing with financial decisions? Why shove that bank statement or that 401k quarterly report in the back of the drawer instead of tackling a money issue head on? And there's a lot to tackle. A recent NerdWallet study found the average U.S. household with credit card debt has almost $7,000 in revolving balances, or balances carried from one month to the next. Do you avoid making financial decisions? Do you try to make them as quick and painless as possible? Do you make decisions in fits and starts? We're at 800-642-1234. Ana Aracela is an associate professor of marketing at the University of Florida's Warrington College of Business, and he studies how we make financial decisions. Ana, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Great to be here.
So your research has found that people view financial decisions differently than other kinds of decisions. Can you tell us about that? How do people tend to think about their financial decisions?
Yeah. So when we started working on this research, we had that intuition that there was something different about financial decisions. There are many other areas in life where we make important decisions, like, you know, choosing a doctor, choosing a car, areas where making a good decision requires a lot of information or expertise, but somehow financial decisions felt different to us, and we tried to develop that idea. And our intuition was that the way we think about financial decisions, maybe one way we are so reluctant sometimes to make financial decisions, is that we think of them in a very stereotypical way about the decisions and about the people who make those decisions. So if you try to think of the sort of the prototypical person who works in the financial sector, you know, you might be thinking of someone like the Wolf of Wall Street.
Or, the black suit, right?
That's right. Someone who's a cold fish, right? Someone who's kind of morally and emotionally apathetic. You might be thinking of, Ben Affleck in The Accountant. You know,
all right. I got
emotionally,
it.
Yeah.
Carry on.
And so to the extent that these perceptions, I would even call them stereotypes, influence the way we think about financial decisions, our intuition was that maybe that's one thing that makes us feel removed and kind of alienated from financial decisions. It just doesn't feel like us. It feels cold. It feels different. And we just don't want to do it.
So really incompatible with our emotions. Does everyone tend to see financial decisions as cold and analytical, or are there certain types of people who are more likely to think that?
So very interesting question. We did find one group of people who tended to be less susceptible to these influences or effects, and those were people who either had personal experience or knew of someone close to them who worked in the financial sector. So, if my brother works on Wall Street, I may not have those stereotypical perceptions about Wall Street and about what the whole financial world means, because I have firsthand experience with that kind of person. I know my brother's not a cold fish. And so that group tended to be more resilient to these perceptions and tended to be less avoidant or demonstrate less avoidant behavior as a function of these perception. So that was a really interesting finding.
So you put a face on that world and you come closer to those making those decisions, perhaps.
Exactly. So the more firsthand experience or knowledge we have about a domain or about a social group, the less stereotypical, the less, you know, removed or distant we feel. And that helps.
We're talking with Ana Aracela. He is an associate professor of marketing at the University of Florida's Warrington College of Business. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel when it's time to make a financial decision about your retirement, of savings accounts, making investments? Do you avoid making those decisions? Do you try to make them as quick and painless as possible? Or perhaps you shove them for another day? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Anair, is there any truth to this idea that being a cold, logical thinker will help you make money decisions? Or is this something that's in your DNA?
Yeah, so there's a There's a good bit of truth in the intuition or the notion that emotions often get in the way of good financial decision making. You know, maybe the best example is how we feel when the market tumbles, right? We experience fear, and we know that that's not a good basis for a good financial decision in that situation. And there are many other examples that suggest that making good financial decisions really is best served by analytical thinking, by careful consideration of all the relevant options, by quantitative or having a quantitative orientation, and things like that. So things that are not exactly compatible with intuitive thinking or relying on your gut feeling and so on. So there is a lot of truth in that. But at the same time, when you think about the way our culture perpetuates these perceptions, almost to a stereotypical level. And I mentioned some movies earlier on, but also if you just Googled something like how not to let emotions get in the way of financial decisions, if you Googled that, you would find dozens of articles cautioning people against letting their emotions get in the way of financial decisions. So I think there's a lot we're being bombarded with this message, and I think it really influences the way we feel about the financial domain as a whole.
I wonder if you are an emotional thinker, does that bleed into other aspects of your life as you go about decision making? Does that render itself in the grocery store or when you're shopping on Amazon?
You know, we were really intrigued by that question, and we actually surveyed a wide array of decision areas. So anything from making financial decisions, decisions in a legal context, in the medical or healthcare context, to things like buying a car, choosing a song, and many, many other areas in life where we routinely make decisions. And we found that emotional thinking really had this unique role or status when it came to financial decisions. So there's many other areas, think about making healthcare decisions, that are really important, really specialized, really difficult, or can be difficult. But turns out that people don't have these perceptions that emotions are just not compatible with those types of decisions. So emotions are not seen as inappropriate in those areas of life. And it turns out that feeling that you are emotional or being an emotional person does not prevent you from making or does not make you reluctant to make decisions in those areas as much as it does in the financial domain. So that was really interesting. We actually we found that across domains, analytical thinking or thinking in a cold, kind of reason-based way, is seen as a plus in almost any area of life, with very few exceptions, like maybe choosing a friend or a romantic partner. But using emotions, that's where we saw the big differences. So that's where we found that it turns out that people do not believe that using emotions is a no-no when it comes to medical decisions, or when it comes to to buying a car, even though it's a very utilitarian, very functional type of decision, so using emotions is perceived as more permissible or as more legitimate. When it comes to financial decisions, people really believe that emotions should not be there. So if I feel emotional, if I perceive myself as a person who has intuition, who uses emotion, I might just feel that it's just not my kind of thing. I'm just not that kind of person.
We're studying how we make financial decisions and reframing how we think about money with Anir Sella. He's an associate professor of marketing at the University of Florida. He studies how we go about making financial decisions and other decisions in our life. You can join in at any point here. Have you ever dreaded making a financial decision so much that you are willing to lose money if it meant being able to put it off? What are your questions about making financial decisions easier and not such a big lift? Do you have any tips for how you do it? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about making financial decisions and why we may procrastinate or not be more proactive in this area of life. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. there's another layer to this issue. Women in particular are likely to leave financial planning to their spouses, and that's according to recent research from UBS Global Wealth Management, which found that 58% of women leave those crucial choices up to their male partners. Younger women, those between 20 and 34, were even more likely to defer to their significant others. So how do you feel when it's time to make a financial decision about your retirement or savings? Do you avoid making those decisions altogether, or do you have a system that keeps you on top of your full financial picture? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Anair Sella is our guide. He teaches marketing at the University of Florida, and he studies the choices we make and don't make. Anair, what do we know about demographics and about men and women as to how they make decisions?
That's a good question. In our data, we found very, very small differences between male and female respondents, and that could be chance. Obviously, there are differences, and you mentioned another research that did find differences between men and women. I think that to the extent these differences exist, even though we found a relatively small trace of them in our data, they can definitely reflect these perceptions of self-perception. So the extent to which people perceive themselves as being intuitive thinkers or emotional thinkers, as opposed to more analytical or reason-based thinkers. So the extent to these self-perceptions vary as a function of gender, which they may very well do. That can drive those behaviors. But there's also other reasons, male and female. Consumers might think about financial decisions differently. So one of them, which is related to our research, is these kind of gender stereotypes or gender roles. So again, if society tells me that financial decisions, there's something masculine about the financial domain, then again, I may think of financial decisions as just something that other people do. If I'm a female and society tells me that it's a masculine domain, I might feel like, you know, that's not the kind of thing that I do. I'm going to let somebody else take care of it. There's also interesting research suggesting that couples tend to divide kind of, house chores and other things between them. But that also includes expertise in financial decisions. So a colleague of mine, Adrian Ward at UT Austin, found that that's exactly something that happens. The more couples spend time in a relationship, the more they tend to specialize. And what often happens is that the female side of the relationship will over time become more and more withdrawn from financial decisions, just leave it to their partner.
Well, let's look at perhaps the integrity of these decisions. In the absence of emotion, do we make better or more sophisticated decisions about finances?
Yeah, so like I said before, you know, making decisions based on fear or gut reaction or regret, or more important, anticipated regret, can really lead to bad decision making. This is a kind of turbulent time in the financial markets, and this is one of the types of advice that we hear repeatedly is, you know, don't pull out of the stock market based on fear, based on some kind of herd behavior and so on. So that's, I think that's one powerful example for how relying on emotions in a financial context can lead us astray. Emotions really don't serve us very well when it comes to making financial decisions. They tend to be very analytical. Sometimes they're counterintuitive. Many concepts and principles that are at the basis of portfolio management, for example, are not quite intuitive.
They can be very complex. I mean, looking at your portfolio, it's dizzying, and there are so many different options and choices. And perhaps if you don't have that MBA or that laying that groundwork in economics, it can feel like really over your head.
So you're touching on a really interesting question, because this question of to what extent does the knowledge that I have compensate or can compensate for these stereotypical reaction modes that I was talking about. And I always think of myself in this regard, because I have an MBA with a concentration in finance on top of a PhD in business. But even I find myself reluctant to sometimes deal with personal finances. Whenever I get a statement from my bank, you know, my initial reaction is to shove it in my desk drawer and never look at it again. So it really suggests that there's something that goes beyond knowledge. I'd like to think that I understand financial products pretty well, maybe even better than the average person. And there's actually a lot of evidence that merely educating people does very little to solve these problems of insufficient engagement with personal finances and people's tendency to avoid or just disengage from financial decisions. So it really goes beyond knowledge. Yes, I understand financial decisions. I know about them. I just don't want to do it. It just feels so cold and so maybe boring, so unemotional, so almost unhuman.
We're talking with Anera Sella, an associate professor of marketing at the University of Florida's Warrington College of Business, and talking about how we go about making financial decisions. Anera, let's pivot here and look at what we can do to become better decision makers, especially in the financial realm. What are some tips you would give us? What can we do to help reverse this?
So there's a couple of things that consumers can do. I'm not promising they're easy, but they can do. We have some evidence suggesting that they can be efficient. And there's some things that financial institutions or vendors can do. So as a consumer, like in other areas of life, acknowledging that you suffer from stereotypical thinking, that you tend to have a biased thinking about a domain or maybe even about a group of people. If I'm thinking about financial professionals, just acknowledging this bias, it may not fix my bias perceptions, but it may help me overcome them when it comes to fixing my behavior. So realizing, what you're feeling, the way you feel about financial decisions, it's not because you can't do it. Yes, you have. It's because they have this unfavorable stereotype. Acknowledging that has the potential to help us overcome the behavioral tendency to disengage from them. So that's one thing. Another thing is we found that kind of reframing the decision, not thinking about it in terms of financial products in financial terms. So think about a decision such as picking mutual funds for your 401k portfolio. Instead of thinking of it as picking mutual funds or picking annuities or picking some kind of a financial product, think of it as a decision about how you want to live in retirement. So reframing the decision, thinking about the types of resources you want to have when you retire, or thinking about your goals.
Doing some visualizing, perhaps.
Visualizing, I'm sure, can help. We actually did something very, very minimal. We merely framed the decision. Instead of calling it a financial decision, we called it a decision about your life in retirement. And we gave people the exact same task. They still had to pick annuities in the specific test that we gave them. We just changed the title of the decision, the label. And we found that really alleviated people's tendency to avoid financial decisions, and it had a particularly marked effect on those people who tended to see themselves as emotional and sort of intuitive thinkers or more affective thinkers. Those people benefited the most from this mental exercise of reframing the decision, not as being about finances, but being about their life.
I think you see that in advertising, too, where you see commercials for financial products and you see some beautiful images of people in sunsets or golfing or doing really fun activities in retirement. And you can kind of see what you're saying right there.
That's right. So I think that this certainly has the potential to help. Another thing that I really like that I came across recently is some products, especially apps that... Well, so many products nowadays are apps that sort of help people deal with financial decisions in a different way, in a way that is either more playful or just brings to mind other things. For example, one app that I really like is called Twine, and it's an app that takes a financial decision and makes it a couple's activity. So it's a platform for making financial decisions with your partner, and it really puts the decision in a different context, and now all of a sudden it's something that you do together. It's something that gives you an opportunity to discuss or make decisions about your future. really makes it not so technical and really more about emotions, about your life, about your relationship. I think that tools like these have great promise and really can make a huge difference, especially for people who have that mental barrier.
Sounds like date night.
Exactly, yeah. If you want to go there, yeah.
Anair, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks so much, Kate.
Anair Sella is an associate professor of marketing at the University of Florida's Warrington College of Business. He studies how individuals, we make decisions. Coming up, we're looking at city life versus the quality of life in small towns. We're breaking down data on regional and local inequality with new data from Gallup. That's after the news here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the economic divide between superstar cities and smaller towns here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our country's 53 large metro areas, those with more than a million people, they represent just 2% of all the places across our country. But they accounted for nearly three-quarters of employment growth since the Great Recession. That's from the Brookings Institution. We're looking at the nuance in regional wealth disparities and what it means for families. Do you live in an area where you grew up in? What has changed in recent decades? How do you compare your standard of living now to your parents at that age? We're at 800-642-1234. Jonathan Rothwell is a principal economist at Gallup. He's based in Washington, D.C. He's also a visiting scholar at George Washington University, focusing on economic and social inequity. Jonathan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So there is sometimes this understanding that certain regions in the nation do better than others. I'm thinking of those big coastal cities. And this is pointed to as reasons for other types of inequality. So sort this out for us. Where does this notion stem from?
Well, there have been a few pretty major forces that have been reshaping American geographic economic conditions. So one is the fairly long-term decline in the manufacturing sector employment, which reached its peak in about 1979. And in the last, say, 10 years, been roughly 5 million lost jobs, although actually since the Great Recession, there's been somewhat of a recovery. So that's one pretty major factor, and that's disproportionately hit rural areas or areas outside of the largest metropolitan areas, with a few notable exceptions. San Jose is a really heavy manufacturing area and is obviously one of the richest parts of the country, if not world. But in general, that's certainly one major factor. And then two more recent phenomena, I think, have led people to really worry about regional economic inequalities. One is the rise of the opioid epidemic, which has played out disproportionately in smaller areas. And another is the surprising election of Donald Trump, who was able to win a fair amount of support in Midwestern swing states like Wisconsin, which had not voted Republican recently, and many people think in large part because of these economic factors.
So when you break down education or you break down quality of life and look at some of that nuance, you say that states are more alike now than they have ever been historically. How can you say that? What does that mean?
So, yeah, given all the things that I just said, you might think that, I agree that this is that regional inequality is a fairly major, causal factor in some of these things. But the reality is much more complex. And so states, just to look at average income at the state level and compare, states to one another, back in the 1920s, there were massive differences in the standards of living and the average standards of living between states. The richest states had roughly six times more income than the poorest states. And that gap has really converged quite a bit. There's now it's closer to two to three time difference between the richest state and the poorest state. And that's been a fairly dramatic change that really happened going up to the 1980s. From 1920 to 1980, states really converged in terms of their standard of living, and they haven't really grown apart since then.
We're talking with Jonathan Rothwell. He's Gallup's principal economist, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel there is a diversity of income and occupations, race and class in your community? Why or why not? Did you live in the city and move to the country, or vice versa? What differences did you notice about incomes, education, and quality of life? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jonathan, your research found that people living in smaller towns or smaller cities tended to rate the quality of their communities higher than people in big cities, in the superstar cities. What is going on there?
Yeah, so that's, to me, a very interesting finding. People are more likely to feel safe in their communities if they're living outside of these superstar metropolitan areas. They're more likely to rate the quality of their home and their community higher when asked in Gallup surveys. And I think a big part of that is their what social scientists call social capital networks are stronger. So there are crime rates are lower. Rates of voluntary participation in civil society are higher. People are usually participating in religious congregations more frequently. They're more likely to give to charity. The percentage of children born to unmarried women is lower in smaller communities. So those are all, despite the fact that income tends to be lower in more rural communities and communities outside of those superstar metropolitan areas, in many ways, the social fabric is tighter. And I think a really important maybe consequence of that is that it's actually easier to raise children to move up economically from a low starting place in rural, less populated areas than it is in the big cities.
What does housing have to do with that and the cost of housing?
I think it has a lot to do with it. It's much easier for parents to find neighborhoods that are predictive of high rates of upward mobility in the less populated areas. And the way that this is measured was by some Harvard and Census Bureau economists who obtained data from the IRS on the incomes of people born around 1980 and then looked at what their parents' incomes were. And they compared people who were born at the 25th percentile of the national income distribution, so fairly low income, people born in fairly low income families, and then tracked where they ended up as adults and how that varied by neighborhood and how it varied by metropolitan area. And really, they found just a huge percentage of variation is explained by the neighborhood, and that neighborhoods in smaller places tend to do about as well as on average as neighborhoods in the very big cities, but cost much less to live there. And so the result is that parents have an opportunity to sort of buy their way into high upward mobility neighborhoods outside of big cities to a much greater extent.
Yeah, and that's interesting because you would think that it doesn't really perhaps matter that much whether you are in a very densely populated urban apartment with lots of community around you or in a sprawling, perhaps a smaller city suburb. What is the difference between that city and rural area in terms of quote unquote good neighborhood? How does that contribute to larger inequality?
Well, there certainly are many good neighborhoods and big superstar metropolitan areas, but the problem is they just are extremely expensive, as people know who live in Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco. And only the richest parents can afford to live there, and often both parents are working two professional jobs and may not even be saving a great deal of money. Whereas if that same family moved to a smaller metropolitan area, they would be able to afford a much larger house in a very good school district. And that's one thing that is the data show is very important for children's upbringing. The school quality varies quite a bit from school to school, and accounts for a large percentage of the variation in terms of where children end up. I think it's certainly a combination of what parents do at home and what opportunities their children have in terms of school. But if you also think about both parents working salary jobs that are very demanding in a big city in order to afford their mortgage or their rent, that means they have less time for childcare. And so they're relying on paid childcare, and the quality may not be as good as what they could give them if they worked fewer hours in a smaller area.
So you're saying that even with these high incomes you see in superstar cities, that may not even buy you the entry point into that quality of life you could achieve in a smaller city.
Right. I think there are real trade-offs. In a big city, it's very clear that you can earn more money, you can be more productive by any measure that economists look at, and you can have a more specialized job doing the work that exactly suits your education. And the more education you get, the more specialized you can get. But there really is that trade-off, because the cost of living is so high and the opportunities for high-quality housing in a neighborhood that feels like a safe community are fairly narrow, that in many ways, a lot of families decide they'd be better off outside of those big metropolitan areas. And so they either leave them or they don't move there in the first place. And that has kind of been a puzzle to economists, because usually the focus is only on the income and earnings potential of big cities. And then they ask, well, why aren't people moving to the big cities if they could earn more money? And the point I'm making is that there's more to life than just maximizing the amount of money you can earn in your career. And those are things that people care about.
We're looking at regional differences between big metro superstar cities and what life is like in smaller communities, especially here in the heartland. Gallup's principal economist, Jonathan Rothwell, is our guide, and you can join in with your observations about city versus rural life at 800-642-1234. Do you feel there is a diversity of income and occupations and race and class in your community, in your neighborhood? Why or why not? Do you live in the big city and then move to a smaller town, or vice versa? What differences did you notice about incomes, education, your quality of life, your stress level? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're learning about why regional inequality contributes little to, total inequality, the whole enchilada inequality. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Second-tier cities are thriving, and by some estimates, they're doing better than the coastal superstar cities. You can think New York, San Francisco, L.A. And another way to slice the data, the differences between people within a city like Los Angeles are a lot sharper than the differences between residents of California as a whole and residents of Wisconsin as a whole. Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you live in the area you grew up in? What has changed in recent decades? How do you compare your standard of living now to your parents at that age? And do you see diversity in race, income, and class? Call in 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Gallup principal economist Jonathan Rothwell is our guy. Jonathan, racial inequalities in cities are well documented. We feel them here in every level of city. What do the statistics say about race's connection to inequality in small cities and rural areas?
Well, one thing we know is that segregation tends to be considerably higher in the larger metropolitan areas. So Chicago Chicago and Atlanta are two examples of the most segregated metropolitan areas in the United States, and have been for some time. Certainly, New York City is, and Washington D.C. are highly segregated. And I think there are clear historical reasons for that. There was a mass migration of African Americans during the Jim Crow era to northern and Midwestern cities. And because that migration happened at a time when Jim Crow policies and practices were rather intense, neighborhoods were explicitly created to house only African Americans or only white Americans. And we're still living with that legacy. Now, when it comes to smaller areas, there just wasn't the same flow, obviously, of migrants. And so they're just those sorts of black-only neighborhoods or white-only neighborhoods didn't really emerge to the same extent. Not that there isn't any segregation in smaller areas, but it's just less extreme than in the big cities.
What do we know about communities where your neighbor is not white, or where there is more integration? What happens in those neighborhoods economically?
There's some fairly strong evidence that it's better for the African American or Hispanic families to grow up in communities that are more integrated. Their access to higher quality schools is better. The neighborhoods tend to be safer than they would be in totally segregated neighborhoods. Arguably, the quality of policing is fairer, and there's less discrimination along those lines. So that has clear and beneficial economic results. I think there's also very important psychological and social and civic benefits to integration that have been borne out across decades of research, showing that white Americans are less biased, less prejudiced when they grow up in areas with other minority groups, and when they're exposed to say African Americans on a mundane basis. They have African American neighbors. They're much less likely to hold stereotypes that are negative toward African Americans.
We're talking with economist Jonathan Rothwell, and we're breaking down forms of inequality, how it stacks up in comparing state to state, region to region, neighborhood to neighborhood. You can join in at any point here at 800-642-1234. Did you move to a particular area for a better school, a lower cost of living? Perhaps a job move brought more money, but in an area with a higher cost of living. So how did you figure that out? What differences do you see between big and smaller communities? Join us at 800-642-1234. Jerry in Sun Prairie called in, couldn't stay with us, but he wanted to talk about transportation, Jonathan. He said that the farther away from the city you are, the more dependent you are on cars and more expensive forms of transportation. How do transportation options affect your quality of life, and how does that differ between the suburbs and the city?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, certainly if you have a long drive, which may be more likely in a smaller area, that's going to negatively affect your quality of life. But I would say in big cities, particularly in the super so-called superstar cities, congestion is a major problem. And if you're commuting from the suburbs, it can take 45 minutes to an hour on a good day. Many people commute more than an hour. And that is a hugely negative aspect of their daily routines. And so I would argue that outside of those big cities, the transportation and commute experience is likely to be better, and it's easier to find housing closer to your job, even though if you're changing jobs, that could be a real problem, because there may be very few job opportunities or only one job that is really suitable. But if you do have that job and you want to find housing close to it, it's going to be easier and more affordable outside of those big cities.
Well, I'm thinking a little bit about the contradiction here that if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere, or that you move to LA because your industry is there and that, you know, if you can make it in that superstar city that you can get by, that you could perhaps be able to get by anywhere. Is there anything to that?
I think there is in the following sense. People can move to those cities and can really specialize and develop their skills and focus on a specific career and do very well. And that the data is clear about that. There are some real advantages to moving to those big cities. But it's once you leave those cities, I mean, it's not as clear that the skills will always find a similar job that, you know, that pays the same wages outside of those areas for when they leave. I know several people who have left big cities to go back to smaller areas and have really struggled despite the fact they were thriving at the top of their careers in the big cities. They just weren't able to find work that used those skills to the same extent.
Well, you started the hour talking about the decline of manufacturing, the Rust Belt, the opioid epidemic hitting rural areas, and the rise of President Trump. Those are three big things there that would impact your data, it seems, impact how you look at the heartland versus your large cities. So where is the disconnect, perhaps, or will it take time for the data to catch up on the impact of quality of life? Because looking specifically at the opioid epidemic, that is very costly for rural America, very costly for the smaller cities.
No doubt. And I would certainly never want to minimize that. And I'm doing some research right now with public health scholars at the University of Pittsburgh to better understand regional differences in opioid abuse and deaths. So I totally agree with the same with looking at political differences. But one thing that we need to keep in mind when considering kind of regional differences and how they play out is that the people are obviously different in different regions too. And so what I found when looking at who supported Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton in the lead up to the presidential election using Gallup data is that really once you control for things like age, race, ethnicity, and gender, and several other things you can observe about individuals, such as their level of education, that the regional differences explain very little. If you take somebody with the same demographic characteristics who lives in the suburbs of a major metropolitan area and consider somebody who looks just like him or her in a smaller area, their voting preferences are very similar.
Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Jonathan Rothwell is a principal economist at Gallup based in Washington, D.C. He's a visiting scholar at George Washington University. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.